I want to introduce Dave Harding with guidance on that. Is that it?
We're talking about Social Freedom Day and Free Software and all that fun stuff.
Thank you. After the main meeting in the cafeteria, you'll get your copy of the free software that we're promoting today.
You just stole my entire speech.
Oh, I'm sorry. First, they ignore you. Then, they laugh at you. Then, they fight you. Then you win. Those are the words Mahatma Gandhi used to describe the state of resistance, nonviolent movements to change. This afternoon, I'd like to introduce you to one of those movements, the Free Software Movement. The Free Software stands for freedom. It's the same free as in the terms free speech or free market. I'm pleased to inform you that the enemies of free software are very clearly fighting us, placing us only one step away from victory, according to Gandhi. But the enemies of free software have also ignored us, and they've laughed at us. I want to start my speech tonight by telling you about how we overcame those challenges. After you hear the history of the free software movement, you may want to join us, or you may just want to use the tools we created in order to create freedom for ourselves. Either way, I will tell you what it means to join the free software community, and I will do it as fairly as possible. I will tell you about the good parts, and I'll conclude my speech by telling you about the not-so-good parts. So, now, let's start with the history of the free software movement, which begins during the heyday of the microcomputer revolution. In 1975, the Altair went on sale. The Altair was an early microcomputer produced by a company called Micro Instrumentation and Telemetry Systems. It was named after the original destination of the Enterprise in the classic Star Trek episode, Amok Time. The Altair was a kit. You bought it, and you assembled it yourself, and after you assembled it, there wasn't much you could do with it, because the only way to program the Altair was to flip a set of switches on the front of it and program in machine opcode language. A teenage entrepreneur saw that as an opportunity. He contacted MITS and he offered to provide them with an interpreter for the basic programming language. The basic programming language would let people program their Altair in something resembling English. That young entrepreneur, Mr. Gates, got his deal with MITS. MITS contacted all their customers and said, "We will soon be able to sell to you, a copy of the interpreter for the basic programming language," which they call it Altair Basic. But Altair didn't get around to selling Altair Basic right away. They kept telling their customers it would happen, but it never did. Something like a lot of other Microsoft products in that regard. But the hobbyists, the people who wanted a copy of Altair Basic so they could use the Altair computer they had bought, became frustrated. And one of them managed to surreptitiously acquire a pre-release version of Altair Basic. He made 25 copies of it, and he brought it to the next general meeting of the Silicon Valley Homebrew Computer Club, a group like your own. And he gave away all 25 copies for a promise. If you took a copy of Altair Basic, you had to come back to the next meeting with two more copies that you could share with other people. Soon, everybody in the Homebrew Computer Club who wanted a copy of Altair Basic had a copy. And Mr. Gates, who was supposed to receive part of the sales revenue for every copy of Altair Basic sold, was quite upset. He wrote a letter to the members of the Homebrew Computer Club, which was published in their next newsletter. The letter was entitled An Open Letter to Hobbyists. And in the letter, Mr. Gates called the hobbyists thieves. And he said that they shouldn't expect anyone to write software for them if they were going to continue to share software among themselves. Except he didn't use the word share, he used the word steal. Mr. Gates' words and the actions of the members of the Homebrew Computer Club are indicative of the status of the computer industry in 1976. When he wrote his letter, and which I understand is when your club was also founded. The people who were part of the Homebrew Computer Club were used to the computer industry, and they were part of a community. They shared all communities are based on sharing, whether it's the sharing of information or it's the sharing of the tools which that community depends upon. Sharing had never before been a serious problem in the computer industry. During the 50s and the 60s, computers cost hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And the people who bought computers expected to receive the rights to use the programs on those computers and expected to receive the source code on the program for the programs on those computers. They needed source code so they could improve the program. And everybody had source code in the 50s and the 60s. During the 70s and the short-lived days of the mini-computer, people shared source code pretty often. Some of the people in this room probably shared source code through groups like the DEC User Society, DECUS. So the hobbyists of the Homebrew Computer Club were used to sharing. They had been exposed to it during their college days or during through their work where they worked with computers. On the other hand, Mr. Gates saw a business opportunity. As the number of computers went from a few thousand in the 70s to a few million in the 80s, Mr. Gates saw an opportunity to sell software. If each person who owned a computer bought one copy of software, there was an opportunity to make a lot of money. But there was a problem in Mr. Gates' plan. And the problem was illustrated by the actions of the members of the Homebrew Computer Club. The problem was that people who were part of the community would share with each other. And when you're sharing a program, you're not making any money. So Mr. Gates needed to alienate users from each other. He needed to make them not be part of the community so that they wouldn't share. And ironically, it was the invention of a member of the Homebrew Computer Club, one of the people who could have shared Altair Basic, that allowed Mr. Gates to alienate users from each other. That member of the Homebrew Computer Club was brilliant engineer Steve Wozniak, and his invention was the Apple. The first Apple was a kit, somewhat like the Altair, but the second Apple was a complete pre-assembled computer that you could buy, plug into the wall, plug into a monitor, press the power on button, and expect it to work. The Apple II was targeted towards hobbyists, but hobbyists didn't buy it, not very many of them at least. The problem was that hobbyists were quite content buying kits, going down into their basements where they could hide from their wives and from their chores, and assemble the computer in bliss. So the Apple II didn't sell very well. What changed the Apple II's fortune was the invention of a Harvard Business School undergraduate, and his invention was VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet. The spreadsheet was immediately deemed a business necessity, and 700,000 copies of VisiCalc were sold within its first few years. But VisiCalc only ran on one computing platform initially, the Apple II, so every new sale of VisiCalc was accompanied by a new sale of an Apple II computer. IBM executives, watching the sales figures for Apple, became quite interested in joining this microcomputer market, and they rushed to market their own microcomputer, the personal computer. Built upon a mostly open hardware platform, the ROMs for the IBM were soon cloned, allowing a commodity PC market to begin. As the people who were building PC-compatible computers didn't really innovate, at least initially, we had a deluge of very similar computers, and with all these similar computers, there's only one thing they could compete upon, price. As the prices of PCs dropped precipitously, more and more people in this room, were able to buy their first computer. They all had the opportunity to come out and join user communities like PAX, but a lot of them didn't. And they accepted for themselves self-imposed isolation from their fellow users. Because they weren't part of the community, they didn't care about sharing, and Mr. Gates found it quite easy to alienate them from each other, to tell them that the price of getting software was that they couldn't share it with each other. Mr. Gates used his business model to build the multi-billion dollar empire we're all familiar with today. Now, before the microcomputer revolution, one of the most innovative computer research labs was the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Artificial Intelligence Lab. The Artificial Intelligence Lab was staffed by many of the original hackers, hackers being, in this case, a term of great respect for someone's programming skills. The hackers at the Artificial Intelligence Lab did most of their programming in the Lisp programming language. Lisp is a programming language ideally suited to solving artificial intelligence problems, but it also has a certain elegance. certain grades. And it happens at the artificial intelligence lab fell in love with it. They began writing programs in Lisp that were unrelated to their work in artificial intelligence. One of the things they wrote was an entire operating system, written in Lisp, configured to Lisp, completely based upon Lisp. The problem was that when they wrote this in the early 70s, there were no computers in the world powerful enough to effectively run the Lisp operating system. So they wrote it out on magnetic tape and they put it on the shelf and they almost forgot about it. Until the late 70s and the early 80s, when computing processor power had increased to the point where it was conceivable that people could build a computer to run the Lisp operating system. Hackers began to leave the artificial intelligence labs to form companies, two companies in particular, to build the computer to run the Lisp operating system. They were very excited about it. One of these companies was called Symbolics. Symbolics licensed a copy of the Lisp operating system code from MIT, and they began improving it. But they didn't give their improvements back to MIT. And the last systems programmer at MIT's artificial intelligence lab was quite upset about this. He had spent his own time adding features to Lisp, working on it, and he wasn't able to see the improvements. He wasn't able to learn from them, and he wasn't able to improve the improvements himself. And he saw this as a violation of his rights. He spent about a year fighting back against Symbolics, but after that year, he decided he was working on a small piece of a bigger puzzle. And he quit his job at MIT to start writing a new operating system, an operating system that would give every user of that operating system the right to learn from the computer program, to learn from the operating system, and to improve it. Now, the new operating system he decided to write was based upon an old operating system. That old operating system was called Unix. It's pronounced the same way you pronounce the word for a castrated man, but it's spelled differently. It's spelled U-N-I-X. And Unix was a commercial operating system from the AT&T company. It had some enviable features, which Mr. Stallman wanted to add to his new operating system. His new operating system was called GNU. That's spelled G-N-U. It's an acronym. It's a particular type of acronym called a recursive acronym. It stands for GNU is not Unix. Mr. Stallman began working on his operating system in September of 1983, and it's partially for that reason we celebrate Software Freedom Day in September. Now, Mr. Stallman thought this was important enough to quit his job because he saw that society was becoming increasingly dependent upon the computer. And as a programmer, he knew that functional computers were entirely dependent upon software. So in order for society to become dependent upon computers and remain a free society, he decided he needed free software. Free software is software that satisfies four criteria that Mr. Stallman wrote. The first criteria is that every user must have the right to run every program for any purpose. We can't restrict programs by what they can do, what endeavor you can use them for, or who you are. A program can't be licensed to you for only use in non-commercial settings. It can't be licensed to only academics. Everyone must have the right to use every program for every purpose, Mr. Stallman said. His second criteria was that everyone must have the right to learn from their programs, and they must have the right to learn from the programs in any aspect, including from the source code. Programs tell you what you can and cannot do on your computer. The law tells you what you can and cannot do in society. In society, we have law code, and it's open law code. It's law code that anybody can inspect and learn from. And to effectively understand how society works, you need to inspect that law code. Programs have source code. In order for a program to be a free program, you need to have the right to inspect that source code. The third of Mr. Stallman's four criteria is that you must have the right to change your program, particularly at the source code level. If you think about our society, we have a free society because we can change our law code. In order for a program to be free, you need to have the right to change the source code. As you can see, law code and source code are very much related. The fourth of Mr. Stallman's four criteria is that everyone must have the right to share programs with their community. Sharing is a good in itself. All communities, like I said earlier, are based upon the idea of sharing. Sharing information and sharing tools. Mr. Stallman formulated these four criteria, again, because he believed that society was becoming increasingly dependent upon the computer. In order for society to remain free, you need to have free software. Around the same time, Mr. Stallman started a new project. In September 1983, four colleagues from two West Coast universities, the University of California, Berkeley, and Stanford University, left their jobs or their studies in order to start a new company. One of the founders of this company was Bill Choi, a famous programmer and the leader of the BSD project. BSD was a set of improvements to AT&T Unix, and it was a set of improvements at the source code level. AT&T had distributed the source code to Unix, to people who wanted it, particularly in academia. And the people, the BSD developers, had acquired a copy of that source code entirely legally. They had looked at, they had fixed a few bugs, and they added a lot of features. Mm-hmm. One of the key features they added was the TCP/IP protocol suite that powers the modern internet. So in the mid-1980s, Mr. Choi leaves his position as leader of the BSD project to found this new company called Sun Microsystems. Sun Microsystems in those days is in the business of selling network workstations. And onto many of these workstations, they install a licensed copy of AT&T Unix, plus the improvements from the BSD project, plus a few improvements of their own. But as Sun Microsystems and other companies like Sun became successful, AT&T became greedy. And AT&T began increasing the price it charged for a license to the AT&T Unix source code. As companies like Sun and other people who depended upon Unix began to feel the pressure of the increasing price, they went to the BSD developers and they asked the BSD developers to stop adding new features. Instead, they said, will you please add the old features in Unix? Will you re-implement the features in Unix so that we can get a copy of the Unix-like operating system from you, BSD developers, without having to pay AT&T any money? While the BSD developers considered this, while they considered changing their focus from innovation to re-implementation, Mr. Stallman went out to the West Coast and began talking to them. He told them, the BSD developers, about his vision for free software and about why he thought it was important. And the BSD developers widely agreed with him. So in 1989, when they announced that they would indeed begin re-implementing Unix, they announced that the results of their re-implementation would be available as free software. Software anyone could use for any purpose, anyone could learn from, change, or share. It took the BSD developers 2 years to finish re-implementing Unix. So in 1991, three things happened. The first thing that happened was the BSD developers finished. They created the first free Unix-like operating system. The second thing that happened was that AT&T went to Sun Microsystems and made them a deal. They told the people at Sun that AT&T would give Sun Microsystems a copy of the Unix code and the right to change it and license it themselves in exchange for a large sum of money, of course. Sun Microsystems accepted AT&T's deal, and they stopped supporting the BSD developers. Right after they signed the deal, the third thing that happened in 1991 is AT&T turned around and sued several of the developers of the BSD project. They went to a judge and they told the judge that the BSD developers were infringing on their copyright, a claim that was largely proven to be untrue later on. And they got the judge to sign a court injunction which prohibited anyone from sharing copies of BSD. Within the span of a few months, BSD became the first free operating system and then went into a sort of legal limbo, where until the case was resolved several years later, it was not freely distributable. Without any competition from BSD, Sun Microsystems continued AT&T's long tradition of selling expensive Unix workstations. Around the same time, the BSD developers announced their intention to begin re-implementing Unix. In 1989, a Stanford University graduate student by the name of Michael Tiemann read through the manual to his favorite free software text editor, call it Emacs. And he found at the end of that manual a curious document written by Richard Stallman called the GNU Manifesto. The GNU Manifesto explained Mr. Stallman's reasons for starting the GNU project, explained what he attempted to achieve through the project, and ended with a call for help, a cry for assistance. Mr. Siemens saw Mr. Stallman's cry for assistance, but he also saw something else, a business plan, a way to make money selling free software. And Mr. Siemens was very excited about this. He told his friends, he told his professors, and he ended up telling strangers about it as well. He was that excited. And after he told everyone, they said, that's a great idea, but I don't want to get into that business myself. It sounds like a lot of hard work. And Mr. Siemens would later write that if everybody tells you it's a good idea and nobody wants to do it themselves, you should definitely do it, because you'll be the only person doing it and you'll have, hey, sort of monopoly on it. So Mr. Siemens finds an excellent microsystems employee named John Gilmore. And together with the third person, they found a company called Syncus Support, and they implement Mr. Siemens' business model, which is very simple at its core. Mr. Siemens goes to five companies that use free software. He finds one feature that all five companies want added to free software. Each company could add that feature themselves because they have the right to change free software. But Mr. Siemens says, no, no, don't add that feature yourself. Don't hire a programmer to add that feature for you. I'll hire a programmer. I'll pay him to write that feature. If you each agree to pay me one quarter of the cost to pay that feature, to pay that programmer to add that feature for you. The companies were happy to accept that deal. They got the new feature for one quarter of the cost of adding that feature themselves. They got a 75% discount. Mr. Siemens was happy to accept that deal because if you get five companies each pay one quarter of the cost, then a nice 25% profit. Better yet, if you can convince more than five companies to pay one quarter of your cost, then you make more than 25% profit. And Mr. Siemens was very successful at finding clients. Started for $6,000, by the end of its first year, Syncus Support had $725,000 in contracts. 10 years after it was founded, it was purchased by a larger free software company for $600 million. A good deal, I'll say. For his work on the free software project, in 1990, Mr. Stallman received a John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. This humbly named award came with a small cash prize of $250,000. Mr. Stallman used the money to begin traveling around the world telling people about his vision for free software. And one of the places he stopped was University of Helsinki in Finland. In the audience during his speech was an undergraduate by the name of Linus Torvalds. Mr. Torvalds listened to Mr. Stallman's speech, and he thought that Mr. Stallman's GNU tool could help solve a problem he's been having. Mr. Torvalds had an apartment off campus, and every day he needed to walk from his apartment to the campus university lab in order to do his homework on a Unix operating system. Mr. Torvalds had no problem walking normally. The problem was that Finland has a long, harsh, cold winter, and it was walking through the cold that was Mr. Torvalds' problem. Now, the year was 1991 when he had this problem, and if he wanted to, he could have, well, if it was available, he could have acquired a copy of the BSD operating system, which was a free Unix-like operating system, would allow him to do his homework at home. But BSD was under court injunction. Nobody could share a copy with Mr. Torvalds. Now, Mr. Torvalds could buy a Sun Microsystems computer, but Sun Microsystems wasn't selling their computers for anything less than a few $1,000s, and Mr. Torvalds was a poor college student, a plight which I see some people in this room are familiar with. So, Mr. Torvalds only had one computer. He had a personal, PC-compatible computer. And he grabbed some GNU software for the PC compatible, and he found that he was missing only one important piece that would allow him to do his homework from home. That piece was the kernel, which is a computer science term for the small program that allows your hardware to talk to your user space programs, allows your keyboard to talk to your window manager or your web browser. Mr. Tobolt wrote that kernel. He wrote a very small kernel, very specific to his own hardware. But it worked, and he was able to do his homework from home in his pajamas. Excited about that, he put the kernel out on the internet. He eventually made it free software, and he eventually had chosen for him the name for the kernel, which was Linux. People began to download Linux, saying, hey, now I can use the new software on my PC-compatible computer. They tried running it, but they found it didn't work, because they had different hardware than Mr. Duvall. So they wrote a nasty email to him. They said, hey, Linux sucks. It doesn't run on my hardware. Make it run on my hardware. Mr. Tobolt went back and he said, no, I'm not making that run on your hardware. If you want this to run on your hardware, go download the source code. It's free software. You can do that. And change it so that it will run on your software. And then send that change to me in the email. I'll apply it to the Linux source code so that other people can run Linux on hardware just like yours. Some of the people who complained did that. And Linux began supporting more and more hardware every year. The problem was that when people sent Mr. Tobolt the changes necessary to make it run on their computer, he couldn't test them. What happens when you add untested code to your software? Well, it has a lot of bugs. So people would download Linux, and they would run it, and they would find those bugs, and they would write an email to Mr. Tobolt and say, hey, Linux sucks. It has all these bugs. Fix the bugs. Mr. DePaul's replied, he said, no, I'm not going to fix those bugs. I don't have those problems because I don't have that hardware. If those bugs are annoying you, fix them yourself. And some of the people who encountered that bug did fix them. If you think about it, the first person who uses a new feature is the person most likely to encounter a bug. The second person who uses the feature is the second most likely person to encounter a bug. If the first person fixes the bug when he finds it, he might be able to fix it before the second person uses the software, before the second person notices there was ever a bug. This gives free software the impression that we have very few bugs. The truth is we start out with just as many bugs as every other piece of software, but we enable users to fix those bugs themselves, so they get fixed pretty quickly. As Linux became popular, people began to combine it with other software. They started with the program from the GNU operating system. Once they had a complete operating system, they were able to give users the ability to choose what additional programs they wanted to install on their computer. So they made collections of this additional software you could choose to install on your computer. We call these collections distributions, GNU plus Linux distributions. And two important GNU plus Linux distributions are started in 1994. The first of these distributions is started as an official part of the GNU project, and it's called Debian. It's a non-commercial distribution which is supported entirely through volunteer labor. It becomes quite popular, and it exists to this day. I use it myself, but it also becomes the basis of many other GNU plus Linux distributions. In the audience today are a whole bunch of people wearing these fancy shirts with the Ubuntu logo on it. And this event is being co-sponsored by the New Jersey and Pennsylvania Ubuntu local communities. Ubuntu is one of these GNU plus Linux distributions based upon Debian. The other important GNU plus Linux distribution that starts in 1994 is called Red Hat. Red Hat is a commercial distribution, and the company that's founded around it becomes very successful. In fact, it is the Red Hat company that purchased Syncus Support 10 years after they were founded. And Michael Tiemann, the co-founder of Syncus Support, is still an executive vice president at Red Hat. Red Hat is again very successful, and many other distributions are based upon it today. Most GNU plus Linux distributions today are based upon either Debian or Red Hat, although there are a few with independent history. As GNU plus Linux distributions became more popular through the 90s and this century, more and more people used them. I guess that's the definition of popular. And as they became popular, the free software movement had gained additional publicity. And through that publicity, you probably know a lot about what's happening in the free software movement during the last 13 years. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time covering it. In fact, you know what? I'll just cover some of the basics. One of the exciting events that happened was in January of 1998, the Netscape company agreed to release their web browser as free software. They did this because they were losing the browser war to Microsoft, and they were afraid that if they lost the browser war, their core products, which were web servers, would be antiquated by Microsoft. Microsoft would be able to control the web browser and control web standards through it, and they wouldn't tell the Netscape people how to build a good web server. So they made their web browser free. They called it Mozilla, the free version. Mozilla eventually forked off just the browser of the product called Firefox. I hope a lot of you use Firefox. Excellent. And Firefox succeeded in the Netscape executive's goal of preventing Microsoft from controlling the web. Unfortunately, it did it a little too late to save the Netscape company's core products. Other exciting things that happened is that companies like Google and Yahoo are based on their servers entirely upon free software. And they've made quite a bit of money doing it, I hear. Other exciting things have happened in free software, but I think one of the most exciting things might happen today. Because right now I'm going to invite you to join the free software community. We're a global community of millions of users, more than 100,000 of which are active in the community every day. And we're a vibrant local community, as you can see from all the people wearing Ubuntu flavored shirts in this room with you. If you join the community, you're going to follow a path that most people who have joined the community in the last 10 years have followed themselves. It's the path from a new user to an expert. You can go as fast or slow as you want. You can walk the path, you can run the path, you can crawl the path. And if you do it, you're going to find some really exciting things. To start the path, you can start in the study room. You can ask one of those people wearing a Ubuntu shirt, or just look around you. There's a whole bunch of free software users in this room. A little less local in this room, if you go across the hallway to the cafeteria, you're going to find we have tables set up where we're giving out free software. We have, I believe, free software for people who use Windows, free software for people who use Apple's Macintosh OS X, and for the adventurous, we have the new Plus Linux distributions that you can install on your computer today. As you use free software, you will discover one of the chief advantages of free software, which is that because everyone can share free software with everyone else, it's easy to get a copy of free software at no price. You don't have to save up $700 in order to buy a license for Adobe Photoshop if you want to indulge your image editing hobby. All of those CDs I described before have a copy of the preeminent free software image editing program pre-installed on them. As you indulge yourself in your own hobbies, you're going to quickly become an expert. You're not going to have to wait and deal with some side hobby while you save up enough money to indulge your real hobby. Having fun is a great way to learn. So have fun. As you become an expert, when you become an expert, you have a great opportunity to begin giving back to our community, which is when I think things really get fun. As an expert, you have the ability to give speeches at local Linux users groups and even at PAX itself. As an expert, you have the ability to help new users. And I'm sure you all know, helping people is a lot of fun. Gives you a really good feeling. As an expert, you have the ability to give back to the global free software community. You can do that through writing canned support, which we call documentation. Most free software products have free documentation. That is documentation that anyone can change and share. And if you're good at writing English and you become an expert, in fact, if you're good at writing any language, I encourage you to write free software documentation. If you're a programmer, you can give back to the free software community by programming. Anybody can contribute code to free software programs. If you become an expert, you have the opportunity to make money from free software. If you think the Singa supports business model, it's a business model that anyone can do. Anyone in this room can find five people, each willing to pay a quarter of the cost of adding a new feature to free software. then you can go out and find a programmer to write that feature for you and take home your tidy 25% profit. That's one of the really coolest features in free software as far as I'm concerned. And there's all the usual ways to make money in free software, the same way you can make money with proprietary software. You can write a book about it, you can get a job working with it. I've written articles which I get paid for, and it's a lot like printing money. Download a free software application, use it for a week, write 1,000 words, and cash the $700 check my publisher sends to me in the mail. Good deal. But if you decide to join our community, if you decide to start using free software, you should be aware there are certain costs for using free software. They're not necessarily financial costs. They're burdens. Things that are going to make it hard for you to use free software are hard to be a part of our community. For example, everyone in the free software community is a real person. That means dealing with people in the free software community requires a skill a lot of people have underdeveloped, which is called tact. To deal with real people requires treating them with respect, which can be quite difficult. If a free software program breaks in the middle of the night, and you might get upset about it because you have a term paper due tomorrow, you can't jump on the local community mailing list and yell at us. Because if you yell at us, we're not going to help you. So the cost of free software is dealing with real people with respect, which means just following the golden rule. Treat us the way you want us to treat you, and everything will be okay. Everyone in the free software community has the same rights. What do you call it when everyone has the same rights? You call it democracy. What's the Achilles heel of democracy? Well, it's debate. We're a community. We know that when we act together, we're stronger than when we act apart. The problem is deciding which actions we're going to take today. You want a feature? I want a feature. There's different features. So which one of us gets to add it first? Which one do we work on first? Well, we're going to discuss it. And our discussions are probably going to turn into debate. Sometimes that debate might turn acrimonious. Even when it doesn't turn acrimonious, it can be very frustrating. I know several people who have left the free software community, either temporarily or permanently, because they couldn't tolerate the debates we have. So one of the costs of free software is going to either tolerate or ignore our debates. One of the most severe costs of free software is dealing with the enemies we've managed to make. Proprietary software companies don't like us because they see us as competitors. Media companies don't like us because they see us powering file sharing. Telephony companies recently stopped liking us because we're powering the voice over IP revolution. We've managed to piss off all these people, and that's kind of bad for us because they're powerful companies. AT&T, for example, has had a lobbying office in Washington, D.C. since 1907. 100 years of lobbying for AT&T. Good job, guys. And these enemies have several potent weapons that they can use against us. They have secrets, they have patents, they have lobbyists, they have lawsuits, and they have lies. They keep secrets from us in order to slow us down. Trying to figure out their secrets, trying to re-implement the feature they added to their software, or trying to support the latest media file format means we have to dedicate resources to reverse engineering that. It means it could take us a few weeks or a few months to support a feature in free software that proprietary software already supports. For example, of a company using it against us, I just found out yesterday that in their re-release of the iPods, Apple has changed the format of data transfer to it. So we free software utilities that work with the iPod can't transfer files, can't transfer music to the new versions of the iPod. It will probably take us a few weeks or a few months to figure out what they did. And they're not telling us. They're purposely not telling us, making it difficult for us. With patents, it means that even if we can figure out how to reverse engineer a feature, we might not be able to add it for legal reasons. That means free software can lag behind proprietary software applications for as much as 20 years until that patent becomes invalid, expires. That's not very fun either. Through their lobbyists and through their legislation, proprietary software companies are able to pass laws that prevent us from adding features to free software for even longer than 20 years. For example, through the DMCA, we're not allowed to add any features to free software that might be considered a circumvention device, which means we can't play legally certain types of media file formats, like DVD discs. Although, if you search the internet, you might find the free software you need. Through their lawsuits and through their lies, proprietary software companies and media companies and telecoms attack companies that support free software. And it's the companies that support free software, like Cingus support, that are the people who are typically adding new innovative features to free software. By attacking our companies, they slow down the rate of progress in free software. The aggregate result of these attacks is that free software typically lags behind proprietary software in features. And that can be a lot, can be very difficult for users to accept that and to deal with it. So the final and, in my opinion, most severe cost of free software is dealing with the attacks of our enemies. The attacks of our enemies are annoying, but they're also a sign, a signal, that according to Gandhi, we're only one step away from victory. People buying their first computers in the 1980s and the early 1990s bought the computer because of its technical potential. Most of them, when they bought the computer, ignored the existing hobbyist community. They accepted self-imposed isolation from them, for themselves. And they accepted proprietary software's requirement of alienation, its prohibition on sharing. Nearly two decades of isolation ended when the internet became widely available, and computer users began to rediscover community. Many of the new communities they formed have been faced with a challenge. How do they overcome proprietary software's requirement of alienation, its prohibition on sharing? Some of these communities have worked around that prohibition on sharing by writing software for the web. If everyone in a given community, say photographers, can use the same web interface, say Flickr, then who needs to share software? The web may negate people's need to share software, but it does not negate their need to learn from and improve the tools they use. Free software has four requirements: that people who use free software have the right to use it for any purpose, that they have the right to learn from it, that they have the right to change it, that they have the right to share it. Only software that meets these four requirements can allow computer-dependent societies to be free, as in freedom. Some of you are already part of a community today, but the rest of you are now faced with a choice. You can choose to begin learning from the tools you use. You can choose to begin changing the tools you use. You can choose to begin sharing the tools you use. The free in free software stands for freedom. It's free as in speech, or free as in free market. It's free as in free choice. So choose now. Thank you very much.